This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we will talk with Dave Miller, who is the president of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association. He's come back from a visit to Washington, D.C. and Capitol Hill to talk with our lawmakers about some needed House finance reforms. And we'll find out more about what Congress may be taking a look at soon. We'll also have Beth Mosier from the Chicagoland AAA office with us to talk about the upcoming Independence Day travel forecast. And more Americans are expected to travel either on the highways, by air, or train than ever before. And we'll hear from Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore about the family and friends in DeMott who are trying to do their best to spruce up and create a new park in their community. These days, we're looking at the expenses of housing finance reform and what actions Congress might happen to take up in that respect. Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association is very concerned about any changes that may come about in the Trump administration along these lines, and they even had the opportunity to visit with folks in Washington, D.C. about it. We have with us to talk about it the president of the Indiana State Mortgage Bankers Association, Dave Miller. Dave, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Great to be with you.
Well, first, if you will, give us an idea from the statewide association's perspective, the concerns that that you and other mortgage bankers across the state have about the current laws and many proposed changes to laws that are going to come up before Congress.
Oh, thanks very much. Yes, the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association, along with the National Mortgage Bankers Association, are working very hard with our state legislators, both in the Senate and in the House, to continue to push forward on GSE reform along with other changes in CFPB enforcement, regulatory relief, the flood insurance bill that just got marked up. I had the great pleasure of actually being in Washington to communicate much of these concerns on all those issues mentioned to both Congressman Hollingsworth, Messer, and Brooks. And then I actually had a little bit of FaceTime, too, with both Senator Donnelly and Young, and communicated everything that's really going on and affecting Hoosiers and how that is being impacted by what's happening in Washington. And I think we're very close, hopefully, to getting some reform done to improve things for folks here at home.
Is it mainly the amount of credit that's available for mortgages that seems to be of major concern to you folks?
It is, and quite frankly, you know, when we look back at you know, the housing market, you know, when we went through the Great Depression and the terrible you know, housing market that existed back in 07, 08, 09, the two GSEs, when I say the GSEs, I'm referring to both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, mm-hmm. They were put into conservatorship by the government, and so the Fed owns them and took them over, and they have complete control. And since then, they have never done anything with it. And we're going on over 9 years now. And that, quite frankly, does not provide for a very stable market for us. And it continues to put taxpayers at risk. So we're advocating to restructure that, to get them out of conservatancy, because we want to preserve the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. We want to continue to maintain and create a lot of liquidity in the marketplace, preserve affordable housing, because we don't believe that those needs are truly being met, and for diversity in housing as well, because we're seeing a great deal of need for diverse housing options going forward because of the tremendous growth not only in the Hispanic community, but in just millennials, for example, that really need better options that are out there that are available today.
I know that the housing market, as well as the mortgage market, looks for younger families moving into either starter homes, the very first homes they may have out of an apartment or maybe some other type of rental, as well as people who are looking for more established homes. And they're also, I know, looking, too, of course, at the mortgage rates, looking very closely. And I know that the 30-year mortgage has always kind of been the benchmark, even though we see a lot of shorter-term loans compared, you know, 15, 20-year mortgages, the like, that are available out there, too. But people still do want that 30-year mortgage for a certain amount of stability, don't they?
They really do. And it really comes down to, and the biggest obstacle that has been and continues to be there, is a down payment. it takes such a long time for consumers to be able to save an adequate down payment for the home that they're after and that meets their needs. And so we're really looking to Congress to help stabilize that, because the current situation we have does not provide us with that long term. And certainly for, you know, millennials today, which right now are making up 80% of home purchases last month, which was a very high benchmark for them, they are having a very difficult time, you know, getting that down payment. And the 30-year mortgage, though, is certainly the most affordable and secure way for them to try to gain the home ownership.
We're talking with Dave Miller, who is the president of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association. Mr. Miller and other folks went to Washington, D.C. not long ago, along with colleagues, talking with Congress members, their concerns about mortgage banking reform that needs to be established nationwide, and of course here in Indiana as well, too. Do you think that if any changes are enacted by Congress, that will in turn make some things easier for you folks as mortgage bankers, but for the average consumer as well, that the underserved communities where we have people that that maybe are able to help pay for their homes if they have had the opportunity to buy them, they'll make it easier for them to be able to go out there and look in for housing, and especially in a market where there aren't all that many homes out there available to them.
Very true. The market is pretty hot in a lot of ways, but there just isn't a lot of available inventory out there. And it comes down to cost as well. And what's unfortunate is that if we go back 5 years ago, the average cost for a lender to be able to originate, process, underwrite, close, and put a loan on the books typically ran roughly around $3,400, $3,500 to the lender as actual cost. Mm-hmm. We're more than double that today.
Good
and
grief.
All of that can be drawn back to the tremendous amount of additional enforcement that came from the Dodd-Frank bill and the CFPB and how they regulate the mortgage banking industry. There were some great things that came out of that, some wonderful consumer protectionism that really went a long way to really clear some things up. But unfortunately, there's so much uncertainty and ambiguity in much of that that it has added so much in terms of cost to regulation that and of course, all of that's being passed on to the consumer. So it's really a double-edged sword. I want to keep those things that are there to protect the consumer and make sure that they have a good, viable option for mortgage finance. But at the same time, we need to figure out how we can lessen some of the burden and some of the costs that are being imposed on lenders here in Indiana to be able to help consumers gain home ownership.
Now, let me ask you, did you come away from your meetings on Capitol Hill and talking with our legislators there about these issues? Did you come away with a sense of something that will actually happen, or at least the promise of something happening, if not this year, but very soon?
I think that there is a real chance this year that we may actually see progress in some of these areas. Certainly on GSE reform, I think there's a lot of attention now being paid to the CFPB and how they operate and some of the proposals there of changing how that operates, going away from a sole director to more of a commission type of structure, et cetera, along with other regulatory relief as it would relate to FHA, VA, and rural housing. Mm-hmm. And you know, quite frankly, some of our legislators, like Senator Donnelly, who sits on the Senate Banking Committee, he is going to be right in the middle of it. And he gave me some very clear indication that he saw much of what we were suggesting to be very viable. His biggest concern was, I just want to make sure that there's enough money. And I assured him that there was no question that if he would support those things that we were suggesting from the Mortgage Bankers Association, there would be more than ample credit liquidity to provide plenty of mortgage finance support to the marketplace. So many of our other congressmen, I think, were very much in favor of what we're doing. There's much of it is very bipartisan in nature. It's just that there are so many other things going on of which you are more than well aware of as it relates to tax or health or anything else that we could talk about that seems to get in the way. So, but I am optimistic, and I'm very hopeful. And I hope that listeners will consider reaching out and encouraging our legislators to act on this to open up the market and help us in mortgage finance.
Now, the congressman definitely pay attention to what the constituents have to say, and we'll certainly hope that they'll make their voices heard that way, too. We've been talking with Dave Miller, who is the president of the Indiana Mortgage Bankers Association. Mr. Miller and others have headed to Capitol Hill recently with words to Congress members, basically a mandate, fix the House financing system. And we thank you very much for being with us, Dave, to talk about this. And we hope that we do see some action come out of Congress definitely before the end of the year. Or thank you for talking about it today here on Regionally Speaking.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, this Independence Day, of course, marks a bit of history, and we find out that there will be a lot of people on the highways traveling for the holiday weekend. And to talk more about it, we have Beth Mosier with the Chicagoland AAA. Beth, thank you for joining us, and give us the stats. How many people are going to be on the roads for Independence Day?
Nationally, we're expecting to see about 44.2 million people traveling, just over 37 million people driving on the roadways. A little closer to home in Indiana, we're expecting to see 1.1 million Hoosiers traveling. That's a bit of an increase over last year, and just under 930,000 people expecting to travel by auto.
Wow, that's an awful lot of people on the highways, and it seems like they'll all be coming through Northwest Indiana, or almost all of them will, it seems like. I know when we have such a busy holiday like that, it's obviously an important points to know here about travel. Some people keep some obvious things in mind. Some people don't. What are some common sense tips people need to remember when they're out traveling on a holiday like the 4th of July?
Well, we always say pack your patience with you because there will be a lot of people on the roads, very busy roadways, particularly as you're traveling through Northwest Indiana with the construction that is there. But make sure all passengers in the car are buckled up. Leave any distractions to the passengers. The driver really should keep away from the cell phone and let the passengers handle that, and the driver really needs to focus on driving.
People will be on the road, so be traveling, and things will happen. Cars will break down, or they'll have some other calamities along the way. What are some of the things that the AAA watches for, and we can tell people about to try to avoid these things?
Well, we're expecting to come to the rescue of 338,000 motorists across the United States this holiday weekend. The primary reasons, dead batteries, flat tires, and lockouts. So if you have not left yet, now is a good time to take your car to a mechanic. Just make sure that your fluid levels are where they should be, your tires are properly inflated, and that you have no battery issues. If your battery is more than 3 years old in your car, go and get it tested out so that we're not coming to visit you this holiday weekend.
AAA keeps an eye on more than just the motorists on the highways. They take a look at things like the airlines and hotel and car rental rates and the like. How does AAA seem to rate things going into this upcoming holiday?
Well, this is one of the reasons that we're seeing such an increase in the number of travelers. Airfares, hotel, car rental rates all down this year over last year, which is a little bit surprising, airfares especially. But nonetheless, people are enjoying those lower prices, and they're getting out there and traveling.
And I know AAA also keeps an eye, too, on some of the best places people can travel and enjoy the summer vacations. And I guess the list includes a very popular spot in Florida. Tell us where the list shapes up this year.
Well, no surprise. Orlando frequently tops the list of most traveled destinations. But also we're seeing some places in Canada, Cancun, Mexico. Seattle is very popular this year. Hawaii is very popular. And we're also seeing some international destinations that are very, very popular. Europe is very popular. Places like Ireland and Iceland, partly because the euro is down from so much and the dollar is so strong over there, but also because airfares are so low heading to some of those destinations. So our AAA travel agents are booking many, many trips over to Europe this summer.
Wow, that's great. If anybody has questions, if they'd like to find out more and maybe cover some of the things we've talked about just briefly here in our conversation, how can they find out more?
They should go to AAA.com.
Beth Mosier is with Chicagoland AAA. Beth, thanks for being with us today, and happy holiday to you, and hope that if you're out there traveling on the road that you're traveling safe as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Family and friends in the town of DeMott are tired of dealing with the problem of dangerously outdated park equipment, so they're raising money to build a new park. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore reports Spencer Park holds a special place in the hearts of DeMott residents.
Spencer Park in the town of DeMott is basically the main street of the town of just under 3,000. Everybody meets here for events and for kids to let off steam. Fairly often now, the sound of kids playing is replaced by kids screaming because this old beat-up park equipment is no longer up to code.
The standards for playground equipment have changed so much that it almost takes the fun out of it, but it's the whole intention is to keep the kids safe from fall slides to whether or not the equipment can potentially hit a child. So the standards that we have are much more strict than back in the 60s and 70s when we first installed this equipment.
It's made Jenny Jonkman, Leanne Dauphin, and Sylvia Stout approach the park to find out what they can do to build a new park. So these three parents got together to raise the money needed, some $200,000. They started Friends of DeMott Parks. They were able to get some manufacturers to give them discounts, and they'll be saving money because volunteers will do the labor. They have their own stories about why they started the campaign.
I have a 5-year-old son, so for 5 years I've been taking my son here to play because this is like the main park in our town. And I was concerned about the condition of the park and the safety. Okay, the first thing that really catches my eye is the three slides here and the wooden structure, because it's literally rotting right now and the wood's splitting. There's concrete exposed, which is not supposed to be. There's no surfacing for protection from falls and such. And definitely the gaps on the playground where children can easily, I've seen children fall from the structure here. So this is my main concern here that bothers me.
I want to create a park that's safe for children to play at and a place for kids to be able to come play, be kids, spend time outside, because so many kids nowadays are, you know, always inside on their phones and tablets and everything else. And I just want them to be kids and have fun and make great memories. When I was a young girl, my mom actually worked for the town of DeMott, and I actually spent my whole childhood at this park. And I have a lot of really good memories here, and I just really hope that, you know, I can create those memories for other kids and my kids as well. What bothers me a lot is they're fun, but the slides are metal, and when it's extremely hot out, they burn your legs. I remember when I was a little girl playing on those slides and them being so hot, feeling like they were burning my legs. That's what bothers me most about the small playground set for like the little toddlers, because I mean, when it's 90 degrees outside, you could probably boil an egg on those. They're so hot. And just to think that kids are out here in the summertime in shorts going down those slides, it burning their little skin. And the other thing that bothers me is just the wood rotting, the concrete being exposed. And it's kind of scary to watch my kid go down the tornado slide. I'm scared that she's going to fly over the edge and fall off of it. So, and I guess the other thing that is very important to me is allowing children that are ADA accessible or, you know, handicapped to be able to play on our playground. Because right now they can't do anything here besides sit and watch other kids play. So, and parents as well. I have friends that are in wheelchairs and that would love to go to the park with their children and play with them, and they can't. And so that would be huge to our community.
It is a big deal, you know, and just like I said, when we drive that 30 minutes with the two-year-old, by the time I get to the destination park, she's asleep. So then I spend the rest of the time in the parking lot with her napping, and then I just drive home, you know. So I want it to be less than a 5-minute commute. And when I say, let's go to the park, she's ready and steady, you know, on her drive. Are we there yet? And then, you know, next thing she's asleep. So the biggest thing is to have a local park for the community to enjoy.
Right now they have $159,000 and they're trying to reach a July 5th deadline so they can knock down the old park and rebuild the new one.
But if we want to do more with the park and add more to the park, it's around $200,000.
They can go to townofdemont.com, and we have a donation page. And that right now is linking them to the patronicity.com page so that they can help so that we can get a match. Because if we get $25,000 of donation, we'll get a match of another $25,000. But after that campaign is completed, we will also have another link, because the DeMott Friends of the Park have created a fund through the Jasper Foundation so that money given to them, we can go straight to the parks.
This is going to be a really cool park.
In DeMott, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
In the United States, breast cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths among women. But cancer mortality in the United States is down 30 to 40% since 1990 because of the implementation of mammogram screenings. Recent recommendations from a group of national experts that advise when someone should begin the screening process, which should or could affect what insurance would cover. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports that has some Hoosiers worried about whether women will continue to have access to these life-saving exams.
Janice Davis is a dog lover. That's her two dogs, Frankie and Bailey. But Davis is also a loving wife, mother, grandmother, and breast cancer survivor.
And I had no family history, so it wasn't, I didn't expect that to happen.
But the unexpected became a reality for Davis 16 years ago. She was 49 years old. For almost a decade, she'd been following her doctor's advice and going for annual mammogram screenings. But this time,
I kept putting it off and putting it off. And, you know, you get busy and you think, well, I need to do that. I didn't do it for a whole year.
Many medical professionals recommend that women begin annual mammogram screenings when they turn 40. One in every six women diagnosed with breast cancer is in their 40s. But last year, the United States Preventive Services Task Force, an independent group that reviews health service recommendations, gave that advice a C grade.
What the C grade says is, we want women to make their own choice. We want them to use the science to make their own decision about when to screen, after talking with their doctor.
That's Dr. Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo, the immediate past chair of the task force, talking to me over Skype. She says the C grade means women in their 40s don't benefit from annual screenings as much as older women. She says women in their 40s are more likely to receive false positive results. But some, including Dr. Perrin Bayani, are concerned about the task force recommendations. Bayani is a breast imaging specialist.
This is looking at the breast from top to bottom, and this is looking at
He's showing me what a mammogram screening looks like. He says the purpose is to pick up cancer way before a woman can feel it, and more importantly, before it can spread.
So if you extend the screening recommendations to every other year or 2 years, well, that certainly gives the cancer a much larger chance to grow in those 2 years and spread, which is not what we want.
The task force recommendations are meant for a broad audience, including physicians and patients, but health insurance companies also use the recommendations to determine how to set policies. For example, the Affordable Care Act covers preventative services with an A or B grade. So if a service gets a C grade, there is a chance insurance providers could stop covering it. It's unclear if that would actually happen with mammogram screenings. But Indiana Congresswoman Susan Brooks doesn't want to chance it. She co-authored the Protecting Access to Life-Saving Screenings Act as an effort to postpone any actions based on the task force's recommendations until 2020.
We know that young women of all ages and even men on occasion get breast cancer. But we know that screenings are important, and if these task force recommendations go into place, fewer women, fewer physicians will recommend that their patients get mammograms.
The bill has to make it through the House and Senate, and it's unclear if it will move forward as a standalone bill or as part of another piece of legislation. Brooks says she doesn't care, but she says there should be a consensus on the guidelines, and those guidelines should be made in the spirit of doing what is in the best interest of women. Bibbins-Domingo says the organization doesn't determine insurance coverage policies. Its role is to look at the science.
But I can't use the science to manipulate the grade that we give a particular recommendation. Our job is to just report on what the science is telling us.
Davis says without the mammogram screening in her 40s that revealed cancer, the outcome for her could have been much different.
If I waited even longer, it probably would have been very much advanced, where it would have been, you know, maybe I wouldn't have lived through it. I don't know.
Davis tells friends and family to have annual screenings done, so if the unexpected does happen, it's more likely to be treatable. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
The Whiting City Council getting ready to take up the issue of some fees to set up one set of fees for solid waste collection, and also taking a look at increasing the water and sewer rates in the community of Whiting. And with us to talk about it, we have Mayor Joe Stahura. Mayor, welcome back to Regionally Speaking today.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be back.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Whiting's trash collection system and why you're asking to set up fees, which I guess maybe make it maybe the last community in the state of Indiana that already has some kind of fee set up.
Yeah, we are one of the few communities that still haven't enacted a trash fee. We pick up our own trash with our own crew, and for years we've been subsidizing it with tax dollars. And with the tax caps right now, it's just putting a bigger burden on the budget. And I elected to ask the council to help us out and to implement a $5 per month fee.
Mm-hmm. Now, does that include recycling collection, or is that separate now?
No, that's going to be all toll $5, and there's going to be a slightly higher fee for businesses and for nonprofits, but I believe that's $10 a month. And mm-hmm. But for residents per unit, it'll be $5, and that'll include both trash and recycling.
Now, when you have the setup between not only the residents, but also you've got larger units as well, too, multi-units, as well as the businesses in Whiting, what kind of service does the city offer these different types of customers?
Yeah, that's another difference between Whiting and other communities is currently we pick up both trash and recycling for free for all residents and multi-units and businesses and restaurants. So we pick up for everybody, and there hasn't been a charge to date. This is just a new fee that we're trying to enact, and I think we're behind the times a little bit from other communities.
Now, I know that this, of course, this major collection effort has been something that has given the city of Whiting something to crow about. It's gotten you up there on the list of cities across Indiana that do a lot of recycling and, in turn, have done your best to keep as much waste out of the landfill as you possibly can.
Yeah, we've been blessed. We actually have... at some point through the year, every unit in the community participates in recycling. So I use the number broadly that we have 100% recycling participation. And we check that routinely a couple times a year to make sure that everybody's participating. But that's actually reduced our cost over time considerably. And one of the things that I try to tell people is that when in 2004, our recycling fees were like almost $300,000. Our total municipal solid waste fees were about $300,000. And mm-hmm. a small community today, we're about $190,000 today. So we reduced our fees because of the benefits of recycling.
Now, the way things are set up right now, where does the Whiting trash go and where do the recyclables go?
Yeah, we work with a vendor. The vendor takes all the recycling from us and takes it to a MRF, which then processes recycling for the secondary market. Mm-hmm. Just same thing with the trash. The same vendor does that, and then he handles it through his own disposal methods and into the landfill. So every ton we can take out of the trash goes to recycling. It goes from being an expense to being a cost neutral item.
Now, when is the Whiting City Council supposed to take up the creation of the solid waste collection fee?
I believe we're actually having public hearings on July 18th, mm-hmm. and then pending the approval after that, within a few weeks, we'll probably have that passed through the council.
And one of the other things that I know that you've asked City Council to take a look at here is looking at increasing the city's water and sewer rates. I imagine probably in large part the fees have to go up because of the same thing, too. You probably have increased costs there, too, don't you?
Yeah, we do. And what I'm trying to do is request the council to kind of put a system in place that will actually be palatable for both the residents and for the city. Nobody likes to get a 30 or 40% increase in their water bill every 10 years. So what we want to try to do is enacted on January 1st of 18, we'd like to increase the cost of living for both the water and the sewer departments at 3% per year. That'll cover any additional capital expenses that we undertake, and it'll also help us maintain the cost of living for our expenses.
Now, as far as taking care of expenses for water processing and the like here, are you finding that because there's some different guidelines for tests and things like that, that's kind of added to the cost?
Yeah, I think we're preparing for that, right? I mean, the state is certainly looking at it tightening testing for lead and making the testing program a little more expansive than it is today. And, of course, once you test and we're doing some analysis of our water lines and trying to keep ahead of it with our capital plan, we'll try to use that money then to kind of stay ahead of the curve.
Now, does the timetable that you've set up here, you mentioned about the solid waste collection fees being brought up here later in the month, or in August, are going to basically, or likely to carry on, I guess, maybe you'll have public hearings on the water and sewer rates at about the same time?
Yeah, actually, we're going to do it all on the same day, and that way people come and speak their, make their voice heard, and I can give them a chance or at least give an explanation for why we're doing it, and so everybody understands that.
Have you heard back from residents in Whiting, especially about having to set up the trash collection fee and recycling fee?
Well, nobody really likes to pay more money, but we've had some great comments and some encouragement. At the same time, people are always concerned with raising fees, but certainly not a big backlash. We're trying to do it logically and sensibly so people don't end up getting hit too hard. At the same time, we're trying to make sure our expenses and we cover our expenses from year to year.
Well, sounds like at least you're off to a good start in trying to get the framework started to create a series of fees at least that will be gradually put in and on a regular basis, and that should lessen some of the impact on residents in Whiting. We've been talking with Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura about the City Council taking up the request to set up solid waste collection fees in the city. They'll have a meeting coming up, of course, next month, and public hearings following as well, and a decision may come from the Whiting City Council on that sometime in August after the hearings. And we know, too, that they have a request in for increases in the city's water and sewer rates as well. And that, too, will also come up before public hearing, before it's finally voted on by the City Council. Mayor Stahura, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. And we hope you'll check in later and have some good news to pass along about the increases. And thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, Chris, thank you.
Northwest Indiana police departments have to deal with the migration of crime and criminals from Illinois every day. But one official says it can be addressed with everyone's help. Lake County Sheriff's Department Deputy Chief of Police Dan Merchak came on regionally speaking not long ago to talk about this.
You know, everybody knows that, and if you lived here and you're part of the region, we blend right in with Illinois and Chicago and vice versa. You can go down the state line, and if you're not familiar with the area, you know, you don't know if you're in Calumet City or you can be in parts of Chicago or parts of Burnham or Lansing, and it all blends in. And, you know, we talk about this now, but really this has probably been going on for years in different, you know, formats and different times when, you know, depending on what type of the crimes, either was bootlegging back in the days or a lot of different things that have happened along the state line. You know, a lot of the streets are the same names. So it's, you know, if you don't know your geographic area, it all looks the same. So the criminals, obviously, you know, they don't care where they're doing their activities at. It's about what they're going to do and making money and carrying out, the crimes that they're attempting to commit. So it all really blends in, and it's probably been going on much longer. I know over the years we've had a big push, especially with the increase in gang activity over the last, 20, 30 years when gangs start to become a lot more prevalent in the area and developing. We've had a big push. David Kapp worked really hard at it. But the local law enforcement has been working at this for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Is there a fear that, and you probably see this on the local level more than certainly on a more regional basis, that there's a fear that about some of the crimes that happen in Illinois coming over here into Northwest Indiana because there's no border, there are no gates, there's no fence between the Illinois and the Indiana state line?
No, there's not, and it's no different if you're up in the northern part of Chicago by Wisconsin or maybe some of the other cities and states that border each other. So, everybody's part of the Chicago metropolitan area here. We have millions of people here. So, you know, crime doesn't know boundaries. Gang members don't know boundaries. So you did have a large spillover here. A lot of them come over here and have set up shop. either selling drugs or prostitution. You know, you have some human trafficking activity that slides over here. So there's a lot of different things that are going on over here. And the same thing can be said for people on this side have gone over there. Obviously, we've seen a big increase from people coming out of Illinois into Indiana. You know, Chicago had an idea of tearing down a lot of their housing developments. Mm-hmm. And that has caused had a large effect and spill over here too.
Is it a case now we're seeing maybe not always the same crimes, but different types of crimes? Or are we seeing cycles where we find like we mentioned before about the fact we've had the prostitution, the human trafficking issues, we have the drug issues that seem to be ongoing? Are we finding different types of crimes that making this wave across Illinois and coming into Northwest Indiana?
I don't think so. I think it's all the same crime. I think people, you know, seen opportunity where they've came over here or they've made connections over here and have expanded. You know, drugs is always one of the biggest problems that's behind most crimes. You know, either you're committing a crime because you have a drug habit and you need money, so it causes you to do robberies or different types of things, or you're over here, you know, selling the product. The people that are here, and you know, there's opportunity to do that here. You see that now with the heroin epidemic we're having, which is across this whole country, mm-hmm. and it doesn't have anything to do with who you are or what you are. Heroin, you know, does not discriminate. People get caught on this. It's a deadly product out there right now. They're mixing it with all kinds of things out there, fentanyl and other issues, and it's 20, 30 times stronger. So you see people from Indiana going over there to buy the heroin, then they're bringing it back over here also.
A couple other things that I wanted to bring up in the chance we have to talk today is talking about the relationship that law enforcement has, and it's not just a particular police department, it's all of the police departments working together with the community to try to build a better relationship in the hopes that they can trying to maybe not stop the crime from happening, but at least catch the criminals faster and get them dealt with quicker and try and at least abate the problems.
Well, there's really two parts to it. The number one part is that we work in conjunction with our Illinois agencies and our partners in law enforcement over there. We have officers assigned to federal task force where they're working in Illinois and in Chicago, and the same thing over here with HIDTA groups and local groups that and, you know, local officers that work along the state line have established good working contacts with their, you know, fellow officers across that state line when they need something. They know a lot of the same players. But the other component is the community. You can't put a policeman on every corner. It's you can't do it. It would cost too much. And that necessarily is not going to solve the problem. You have to have the community. The community is the eyes and ears out there. They know what's going on, and it's about them getting involved and stepping up. You know, there's the code out there, don't talk to the police, don't say anything. Well, that doesn't work. And, you know, the overwhelming majority of people, I don't care what neighborhood you live in, they want a nice neighborhood. They want a safe neighborhood. They want good schools. They want clean streets. They want everything that anybody else wants. So it's difficult sometimes, I think, for people out of fear and retaliation to talk. But community policing has to be a number one component of doing it, because you can't arrest your way out of this situation.
More voices soon on the subject of crime spillover from Illinois into Northwest Indiana. Federal housing officials will hold a public hearing tonight on plans to tear down a lead-contaminated public housing complex in East Chicago. The demolition plan got federal environmental approval last month, but Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports that the locals want to have a chance to raise concerns.
Residents from the West Calumet housing complex area wrote to the Department of Housing and Urban Development this month. They asked for a public hearing and more time to comment on the demolition plan. This was after HUD issued its environmental assessment, which says the demolition will have an impact but is necessary to protect human health. The federal agency said it would be able to offset the disturbance of toxic soil during demolition. After that, the Environmental Protection Agency plans to clean the area to a residential standard, though the city of East Chicago hasn't decided on a future use for the land. HUD officials have said they don't expect it'll be public housing. But residents and their lawyers worry demolition alone could unearth more toxic soil, spread contaminated dust, pollute groundwater, or harm workers on site. HUD officials granted them the hearing to raise those concerns and extended public comment on the environmental assessment through early July. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Coal companies are required to restore former mines to make the area look like it did before they mined it, but those companies are not required to manage the land after it's restored. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen traveled to southern Indiana not long ago to find out how one group is transforming a former mine into a wildlife oasis.
Vigo Coal Company surface mined about 700 acres of the Columbia Mine in southern Indiana in the 1990s. The company then reclaimed or restored the area. It filled in all the rocks and dirt and planted some trees and grasses.
But then it sat there for about 10 years.
Bill McCoy manages the Patoka National Wildlife Refuge east of Princeton.
In that time period, nothing had been done to it, and all these invasive species started to grow.
Invasive plants that include calorie pear.
Autumn olive.
Tall fescue.
And Sericea lespediza.
Some of those are familiar to many Hoosiers. People like to plant them in their backyards. They're even sold at home improvement stores. But once these plants get a foothold, they run wild. Plants and animals spread their seeds. And there were a real problem at Patoka, says Abby Perfetti. Perfetti works for Sycamore Land Trust, a Bloomington land preservation group.
And they're not just like quietly doing their thing. They're taking over. They choke out everything else.
Patoka and Sycamore decided they needed to restore the restoration. So in 2012, Sycamore Land Trust purchased the Columbia Mine. And McCoy says the federal government bought the right to manage the property, basically forever.
Our goal was here and now, habitat for wildlife that doesn't have habitat elsewhere.
Fast forward to 2017. The group just got a $20,000 grant from Alcoa, the big aluminum producer, and American Forests to continue the restoration. It's hard to tell what's invasive and what's not when you go out to the old mine. Luckily, I'm with Bill McCoy.
This is the common milkweed, which is the number one plant species that monarch butterflies depend on. But right next to it is autumn olive. And if we wait till next year, it'll completely wipe out the milkweed.
One side of the gravel road we're on is dense, shrubby forest. It would be really tough to walk through. The other side looks more like a prairie. There's a handful of oak trees and some dead brown bushes, invasives McCoy and his team killed with herbicides.
Basically, you'd like this area that we're looking at right now to look more like what's behind us. You know, mostly grasses and a few big trees. And
yeah, we call it oak savanna.
McCoy gets excited when he talks about the wildlife that comes back when invasive species are cleared out. Birds, crawfish, amphibians, even bobcats all have a place to live.
We know what it will be like if we manage it right. It'll be totally unique and special, and we'll have those species here that we wouldn't have otherwise.
Patoka also makes sure the invasives don't go to waste. McCoy and his team wrap the removed plants in a big bundle, and they toss them in nearby lakes along with some boulders. This creates habitat for fish and other aquatic life.
Just picture yourself if you were running, had an aquarium in your house and you wanted to provide hidey holes for the little fish, you create a pile of pebbles and that gives them shelter. That's what we're doing, only we're doing it on a natural scale here.
It's a pretty efficient process, and that's important. Habitat management and restoration is expensive and time-consuming and labor-intensive. Coal companies reclaimed about 125,000 acres of mined land since 1990. Only a fraction is restored further for wildlife habitat. And most of that work is done by private landowners. Sycamore's Abby Perfetti says if Hoosiers want to see more habitat management on reclaimed land, they have to fight for it.
It's a choice and it's a conscious effort that people have to make. And it's what we keep emphasizing is that it's a collaboration because none of us could do this alone.
Collaboration like this one with Sycamore, Patoka, Alcoa, and American Forests. McCoy says his group will put the new grant to work later this year. He'll remove invasives and use them to build lakeshore habitat, a practice he says is unique to Patoka. Workers from Alcoa's Newburgh plant will also come out to the old mine to plant native trees. McCoy says it'll take about 3 years before they know if the restoration succeeds. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen in Patoka National Wildlife Refuge.
On this Monday, it's time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Barb Holeiter and Donna Chant, who are with the Munster Parks Department. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Hi, John.
Hi. So you've been, this is called the Grape Escape, this event that's coming up.
Yes.
And when is it going to take place?
It's taking place on Saturday, July 15th.
Okay. And I have to admit that, shamefully admit that I've never attended the Grape Escape. What have I been missing?
Well, I hope that changes this year.
Yes, I do too. I'll actually be in town, I know, too, so there will be no excuse for it.
Well, the Grape Escape started in 2010, so this is our seventh year running it. Originally, we had three wineries. It has grown. Right now, we have four confirmed. It's lots of fun. There's lots of things going on, from concerts, bands all day, to mm-hmm. winery tastings, beer.
Mm-hmm. What are the hours for the event?
The event is from 12 noon until 8 o'clock at night.
Oh, nice long stretch.
Yes.
With all kinds of activities.
Yes.
All these activities going on. And people can sample the wines, I assume.
Yes. We have four wineries right now, Cedar Creek Winery, Buck Creek Winery, Easley Winery, and Windy Ridge Vineyard and Winery. And each winery offers 1 ounce tastings mm-hmm. of all their different wines. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, you can buy a bottle of wine. You do have to take that to your car. Mm-hmm. You can buy glasses of wine that you can drink during the concerts.
Mm-hmm. That sounds blissful.
It's very nice. We go all out. We have tables that are covered in nice grape-colored purple tablecloths. And we have chairs and tables out. It's very nice. There's also bench seating. And you can bring your own chairs if you'd like.
Do people bring blankets and sit on the ground? And
they sure do.
Do that kind of thing?
They sure do.
And you have food available?
Yes, we have food trucks.
Oh, I love food trucks. That's such a cool trend.
It is.
Yeah, that's neat. So tell us a little bit about the bands.
Well, we'll be starting off the day at 1 o'clock with David Alamillo, who is a local acoustic soloist. He performs Americana and folk music. Mm-hmm. And then at 3:30, we have a six-piece band called Metropoli, and they play a variety of music genres. And at 6 p.m., our featured performer is Piano Man, and he does an Elton John, Billy Joel tribute.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be lots of fun.
Yeah. Oh, I should find out more about him. Maybe he could perform with the Northwest Indiana Symphony sometime.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I love those kind of cover artists who do that sort of thing with symphony in symphony settings. That's mm-hmm. People really like it too. Mm-hmm.
They're very talented.
Have you and anybody else?
No, just those
okay.
three.
And have you had those performers before in years past?
No, they're actually all new.
Really?
This year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find Piano Man?
We go to a music showcase every year in Illinois, mm-hmm. and they offer a variety of 5-minute shows by different performers, mm-hmm. and then they have a vendor show at the end, mm-hmm. and you can meet all the performers and go talk to the people that you saw mm-hmm. and visit with other people. So that's where we do get a majority of our bands from.
So is this a family event, or because of the wine, I'm asking?
Right. No, this is kind of unique for us because most of the Munster Parks programs are geared toward families
yeah.
and kids, but this is definitely 21 and older.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, because I was sitting here thinking, if I were a listener, I would be wondering that. You know, mm-hmm. Who all can I bring with me? Well, that's good, though, because, as you say, you already do so much for families, and the park, that whole stretch of this is at Centennial Park?
Yes.
I assumed, yes.
Right.
And there is a family, alternative or option, because this year we're partnering with the Fetching Market.
Oh, right.
And they're going to bring about 100 vendors, antique, vintage, retro vendors. That starts at 10 o'clock at Centennial Park.
Mm.
And so families can come to that, of course, and shop and, mm-hmm. you know, browse and eat food.
And does that go on all day, too?
It goes on till 6 o'clock.
Well, mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. it's going on at the same time, and it's
yes.
right.
Correct.
It's adjacent to
correct.
The Grape Escape.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that sounds like a lot of fun to do those things. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been to one of those fetching markets yet, but I really mm-hmm. want to. I like antiques and vintage mm-hmm. stuff. So, oh, sorry. I just got a text. Silence your phones. Well, that does kind of bring us to an end of our time together. But thank you for being here, ladies, to tell us about the Grape Escape and also the Fetching Market, for that matter. Yeah. And I wish you a good event, and I plan to be there.
Good. Well, that would be great.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Art.
Maybe that was a text telling him that his time was up. That was John Kane talking with Barb Hohleiter and Donna Chant from Munster Parks Department about the Grape Escape coming up on Saturday, July 15th. You can hear this conversation again and other Eye on the Arts online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and join us next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for today's Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.